Welcome back to Counting to Five, a podcast about the United States Supreme Court. The following is the audio from the Counting to Five weekly YouTube live stream, originally broadcast on Thursday, February 22nd, 2018, at 9 p.m. Eastern Time.
And if you are watching this live, please feel free to ask questions at any time in the YouTube live chat, and I'll try to monitor that, and I can periodically answer questions as they occur. I just want to say there's a lot going on at the court this week. There's a lot to cover, so I'm necessarily going to be kind of keeping things relatively brief, but if there's any cases or anything I'm talking about that you'd like to hear more about or have questions about, just please ask in the live chat, and then I can try and do that for you. So the purpose of these weekly live streams is just to try and keep up to date with the latest Supreme Court news. So we're just going to cover everything that's been going on at the court in the past week and give a little preview of what's coming up next week. So this week, the court returned for oral arguments after a bit of a break since the January oral arguments. That about 4 weeks off between the January argument setting and coming back this week for the February arguments. In last week's live stream, we previewed the four cases that the court was going to hear this week. Just for time reasons, we're not really going to talk much more about those, but on Tuesday and Wednesday this week, the court heard those four cases. And so sometime later this spring, we'll get decisions in those. But I'm going to move on and talk about the new business, other new things that were going on this week. So Tuesday morning, the court was off on Monday for the, Washington's birthday holiday. They came back on Tuesday morning and issued their orders list. This is the list of orders that come out of their private conference that they held the previous week on Friday. This orders list this week was mostly just routine matters, not too much of a whole lot of interest, but there were a few items that are worth talking about. The orders list included an opinion summarily reversing a lower court decision and also a strongly worded dissent by Justice Thomas from the court's decision not to hear another case. I'll talk about each of these in a few minutes. And then Wednesday morning, the second day of oral arguments this week, before beginning the day's oral arguments, the court issued opinions in four argued cases. Now, before yesterday, the court had only issued four opinions total for the entire term so far, which was a very slow pace for them. So basically, yesterday they doubled their output for the term so far by issuing another four opinions. And in a little while, I'm going to briefly summarize each of those opinions, talk about what those cases are about. There's also a bit of news tonight related to several death penalty cases. There were actually executions scheduled in three separate states that were set to occur tonight, the February 22nd, and there were petitions and applications for stays of executions in all three of those cases, and I'll talk about what is going on with those three cases in a little bit. And then finally, next week will be the second week of the court's February argument session. The court will be hearing arguments in five cases next week, starting on Monday, running through Wednesday. And I'll talk briefly about each of these cases. There's a lot to cover, so I'm just going to dive right in. The first item is not a case, but a milestone. This past Sunday, February 18th, marked 30 years on the court for Justice Kennedy. He's currently the longest serving justice on the court. In the court's history, he's only the 15th longest serving justice. The record is held by Justice Douglas, William Douglas, who retired in 1975 after serving for over 36 years. So Kennedy's still a few years out from the all-time record. Kennedy is right now 81 years old. He's not the oldest current justice. That would be Justice Ginsburg, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's 84 and almost 85 years old. But at 81, he's getting up there in age. They're also not quite at the record for the oldest ever on the court. The oldest justice ever to serve on the court was Oliver Wendell Holmes, who retired in 1932, followed closely by Justice John Paul Stevens, who retired in 2010. And both of them, Holmes and Stevens, were 90 years old at the time of their retirement. So Kennedy still has a few years left before he reaches that mark. Now, Kennedy is very closely watched because he holds a particularly important position on the court. He is and has been for some time what's referred to as the median justice. And that's if you were to arrange the justices basically from ideologically from left to right, just kind of a simple linear arrangement left to right of the justices. Kennedy is the justice that falls in the center. He's the fifth out of nine justices. And what that means is that in closely divided cases, he has he tends to more often be in a position of casting a deciding vote. That kind of a arrangement, that the linear left to right arrangement of the justices, more liberal, more conservative, it's kind of a simplistic, one-dimensional view of the justices, but it definitely does capture an important, a generality about the justices and how they tend to vote. And in particular cases, the justices aren't quite so, necessarily so simple to pin down, but over the bulk of the court's caseload, there's, as a rough generality, you can kind of position the justices. And Kennedy also, in addition to being the median justice, he's also thought of as what's usually referred to as a swing justice. So he's generally a member of the court's more conservative wing. There's five justices on the court that are kind of the conservative block of the court, all appointed by Republican presidents. There's four justices on the court that are the liberal block. But Kennedy is in the position where he more frequently than the other members of the conservative block tends to vote with the liberal wing of the court, including in some key kind of hot button issues that really divide the court, and that has included abortion rights, gay rights, affirmative action. Those are cases where he has found himself in some of those areas. He's been found on both sides, depending on the particular cases. But they're places where he often sides with the liberal justices against the conservative justices in certain cases. So he has this, he's kind of has a very important and powerful position. He is the deciding vote in more cases than any other justices. So he is in the majority of 5-4 opinions. When the court divides 5-4, he is in the majority more than anyone else on the court. And so that means his vote is particularly important, and it's often very keenly sought by advocates before him. And Kennedy, I mentioned he's 81 years old. He's been on the court now for 30 years. How much longer will he stay on the court? No one knows. His retirement is a subject of constant speculation. There were rumors going around last term that he was planning to retire at the end of the term. It turned out to be unfounded. The term ended and he's still there. He's given no public indication of his intentions of when he plans to step down. And he seems to kind of relish his role as the pivotal justice in so many cases. He kind of seems to have an understanding of the kind of power that he has given his position on the court. But each anniversary or birthday is kind of a reminder this can't go on forever. At some point, he will step down, and that will change the shape of the court. So that's just an interesting milestone. But now let's move on to the court's business. One other thing I want to touch on quickly. This is kind of a dog that didn't bite or bark. This is the Tuesday's order list. The court didn't grant review on any new cases. So they have not added any new cases for next year. Now, there was one case that was being very closely watched, and it was a case, and I've talked about this a bit in a few previous weeks' live streams. It's a case about the DACA, that's the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. And what happened was this is President Obama's policy that gave deferred status to certain immigrants who came into the United States as children and then satisfy certain other criteria. And what had happened is the Trump administration had decided to rescind that policy and wind down the DACA program. Some legal challenges were brought to that. There have been two lower courts now that have issued injunctions ordering the government to continue the DACA policy, keep that policy in place, and basically telling the government that it can't wind down the program the way it tried to. The Trump administration had asked the Supreme Court to immediately take one of these cases to have it decided as soon as possible. And the court had ordered, previously expedited briefing in this case to allow the court to consider whether to take it sooner. And this past Friday, was when they had scheduled to consider this case. So it was thought that the court might grant that case and try and squeeze it onto this year's docket. It's a bit late for the court to be adding new cases, but they could expedite things and fit it in later in the term if they really wanted to. The expectation was if they were going to do that, they would have put out the order granting that case Friday night just to get things moving as quickly as possible. So they'd have their Friday conference and they would have got things moving that same day. They've done that in the past when they want cases to really to get the briefing schedule to get started immediately and not waited for Monday. But there was no grant on Friday, and then no action again in Tuesday morning's orders list. And then subsequently on the docket for the case, that case was relisted for this Friday's conference, so for the court's next conference. So that means it's officially up for consideration again this Friday. And there's many reasons the court might do that. There's really no telling from the outside what exactly that means. One strong possibility is that the court has is going to deny review in the case, that there isn't enough votes. They need four votes to accept a case, so there aren't four votes there to accept this case and put it on the calendar for this year. However, that there are one or more justices who intend to write opinions, issue opinions, possibly dissenting from that denial and expressing why they think the court should have taken it. That's one possibility, but we really won't know until the court finally disposes of that case. So now let's move on to what the court actually did. That's what the court didn't do, but let's look at what actually happened. So a few other important developments that came out on Tuesday. There was one opinion on Tuesday. Now, this was a per curiam summary reversal. Now, per curiam opinion is an opinion, an unsigned opinion. It doesn't indicate it's written by a particular justice. And this is typically what's done in these summary cases, which is cases that are decided without full briefing and without oral argument. So they took this case. They had a petition to hear this case, and instead of putting it on their calendar to hear it, they just immediately issued an opinion reversing the case. And this case, it's called CNH Industrial v. Reese. And this case is kind of the fairly rare case of what's known as error correction. The court usually sees its role in the choosing cases to hear. Its role is basically providing uniformity of federal law. So it likes to take cases where different lower courts have differed on the correct legal rule, and so the court steps in to kind of make things uniform, and also just to decide issues just of great public importance. So when there's some major federal statute that's called into question by a lower court or something like that, the court will step in and take those type of cases. But the court generally takes the position, the justices take the position, that just the mere fact that a lower court made an error, did something wrong, is not a sufficient reason to grant cert. The court, many lower appellate courts, the federal courts of appeal have this role. A lot of state courts of appellate courts have the role where their job, part of their job, is just to fix any errors or mistakes that happen in the courts below them. Just cases can be appealed if there's just some legal error or even factual errors in certain cases. But the Supreme Court doesn't really usually see that as its role. However, once in a while, occasionally through, every term, occasionally it uses these summary decisions basically for error correction. It's not a case that the court wants to take up time on its docket with, but it wants to kind of fix something that was done wrong in the lower court. And often the strong impression you get from these cases is that the Supreme Court saw a lower court that was kind of flouting precedent or ignoring kind of the clear direction from the Supreme Court. And this seems to be a case that kind of falls into that category. Now, what this involved, it was a collective bargaining agreement involving CNH Industrial, the employer here. And it was a 1998 collective bargaining agreement. And one of the features of the collective bargaining agreement is that it included healthcare benefits for retirees from the company. Now, that agreement, that 1998 agreement, by its terms, it expired in 2004. The agreement didn't explicitly state that the retirees' health care benefits also expired in 2004. So this was a lawsuit brought by the retirees after the expiration of the agreement, arguing that they're entitled to continued health benefits under the agreement. What happened here, just to run through this really briefly, is this was heard in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And the Sixth Circuit had an old case, a case from 1983, this referred to as the Yardman case. And that case, the Sixth Circuit had held that, there's a presumption in many cases that benefits to retirees, should be presumed to be for life rather than just for the duration of the agreement. And this is referred to as the Yardman inferences in the Sixth Circuit. So this is kind of a particular, legal rule for interpreting these kind of, collective bargaining agreements that developed in the Sixth Circuit. Now, in 2015, the Supreme Court took a case from the Sixth Circuit and expressly rejected these Yardman inferences. They said that when you're interpreting these agreements, you just apply normal contract principles. They said that the Yardman case was inconsistent with these normal principles, and so they rejected the application of that. So that brings us to this new case, the CNH Industrial. And what the Sixth Circuit did was they kind of revived this Yardman, even though the Supreme Court had rejected this approach. They applied these same Yardman inferences, but just in a little different context. Instead of applying that to definitively say what the contract provided for these health benefits for life, instead it applied these inferences to find that the contract was ambiguous between having these benefits terminate with the contract in 2004 and having them extend as lifetime retirement benefits. And by finding an ambiguity, that opened up the possibility of looking beyond the terms of the contract, looking outside for other evidence to resolve that ambiguity. Now, the Supreme Court in this decision that came down on Tuesday basically said it doesn't matter whether you're using these Yardman inferences to establish the meaning of the contract or to establish an ambiguity. Either way, it's inconsistent with normal contract principles and shouldn't be, it just isn't appropriate and shouldn't be applied. So this was kind of the Supreme Court really slapping down the Sixth Circuit. And the Sixth Circuit itself, it's worth noting, was internally divided over the continued use of this Yardman inferences. A 2016 case in the Sixth Circuit was actually decided the opposite way, where the judges on that case said that the Yardman inferences didn't apply. And then this new case went the opposite direction. That isn't supposed to happen on the courts of appeals. Normally on the circuit courts of appeals, when one panel, that's one three-judge group that's hearing a case, decides a particular legal issue, that's binding on other judges on that circuit, unless they decide as an entire court, all the judges on that court, it's what's called going en banc. That's when all the judges on the court get together to resolve, you know, overturn bad circuit precedents or resolve these kind of things. So this was kind of the Supreme Court stepping in and just saying, you know, the Sixth Circuit is just not doing things right here. They're not listening to what we've told them in a previous case. And so they stepped in to do that. So that's that case. There's another order, a development that came down also on Tuesday. So there were numerous denials of petitions for review. So every time one of these orders lists come down at the court's conferences, it's regularly considering a large number of petitions for review in various cases. Over the course of the year, they get somewhere like 6,000 or 7,000 petitions, and they only take maybe 70, depending on the year. So they're denying, you know, sometimes hundreds of these. And generally, these are just it's a single line on the orders list that indicates the case that's being denied, and there's no commentary, no opinion, no nothing. But once in a while, a justice will write an opinion, often disagreeing with the denial of cert. That's the granting the order to take a case. So a justice will sometimes issue an opinion specifically dissenting from the denial of cert. And that happened this week in a case called Sylvester v. Becerra. Now, this was a case out of California, and it involved a constitutional challenge under the Second Amendment to a California law that imposed a 10-day waiting period for gun purchases. And this was specifically a challenge to this law as applied to people who already own guns. And the argument was that any purposes served by this 10-day waiting period, it's one of the main purposes behind this type of waiting period is the idea that it provides a cooling off period. So if someone is going to do something, commit some rash criminal act with a gun, and you make them wait 10 days between purchasing it and being able to actually acquire the gun, that gives them time to reconsider their actions, cool off, and prevent violent acts from happening. That's the theory. But the challenge here was for people who already own guns and are known to own guns under California's registry that keeps track of who owns and possesses guns, the cooling off period doesn't necessarily serve any purpose, as the argument is made, because these people already have access to guns. They already could use the guns if they had some immediate purpose that they wanted to use it for. In any case, the lower court, which is the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, in this case, the lower court rejected this constitutional challenge, and petition was made to the Supreme Court, and the court declined to take this case, and that resulted in a lengthy dissent from Justice Thomas. And this is not unusual for Justice Thomas. Over the years, he's had a number of these dissents from denials, specifically in Second Amendment cases. And there's a couple pieces to Thomas's criticism of the lower court. And he directly kind of criticizes his colleagues, the other justices on the Supreme Court. Now, first, his criticism of the Ninth Circuit, the issue here is the standard of review that was being applied by the Ninth Circuit in considering whether the California law violated a constitutional right recognized under the Supreme Court's cases on the Second Amendment. And this involves is a concept that is referred to as tiers of scrutiny. It's kind of may seem like a strange concept, but various different constitutional claims the courts have over the years decided that certain types of constitutional claims should be subject to different levels of scrutiny by the courts. And what this does is it allocates – one thing these different tiers of scrutiny do is allocate the burden of proof. So is it the burden of the challenger of the law to demonstrate – that the law is invalid, or is the burden on the government to demonstrate the constitutional validity of the regulation that's alleged to infringe on some constitutional right? And also, what level of deference is the government given? So how much flexibility do they have in kind of connecting their rationale, their arguments for why this is a valid law to the actual law that they've enacted? And There's three different categories that are usually type constitutional rights are usually placed in. The lowest level is what's known as rational basis review, and then the higher levels are called intermediate scrutiny and strict scrutiny, with strict scrutiny being the most difficult types of rights for the government to justify infringing on. But the main divide is usually between rational basis and the other forms of heightened scrutiny, intermediate or strict scrutiny. And it's often said that the level of scrutiny is decisive in many cases. So once the court decides what level of scrutiny applies, that is really the end of the case in many circumstances. Now, that can be a little overstated. It doesn't always work out that way. But the phrase that's often used is strict scrutiny. That's that higher level. So it's strict in theory, but fatal in fact. Meaning, if the government has to satisfy strict scrutiny in order to have some law apply or a law remain valid, and that goes for things like race-based distinctions in statutes and government policies. It goes for restrictions on core First Amendment rights, things like that. They're subject to this strict scrutiny where it's very difficult for the government to survive that. On the opposite end, rational basis, victories by plaintiffs challenging a law that's only subject to rational basis review are very few and far between. It's generally a very forgiving standard that's easy for governments to satisfy. Now, the Second Amendment that we're talking about in this case, it was the court, District of Columbia v. Heller, was the 2008 case, Supreme Court case that really put the Second Amendment on the map as a protected constitutional right. But that case didn't explicitly decide what the correct standard of review is that should apply in general cases brought under the Second Amendment. But Justice Thomas argues that it was clear from the opinion that it was not rational basis. It was some form of heightened scrutiny. He argues, however, that the Ninth Circuit, while claiming to apply heightened scrutiny, like an intermediate scrutiny, is in fact actually doing something that really looks like rational basis review and is not actually giving any real level of scrutiny to the justifications that California put forth for its law. So that's kind of his substantive critique of what the Ninth Circuit's doing. There's kind of a broader context of what he's complaining about, and he uses fairly pointed language both toward the Ninth Circuit and toward his colleagues. And he, so here's just a little language from the introduction to his opinion. And he writes, "If a lower court treated another right so cavalierly, I have little doubt that this court would intervene. But as evidenced by our continued inaction in this area, the Second Amendment is a disfavored right in this court." And later on, he says in the opinion, he specifically refers to the lower courts, what he sees as their disobeying the clear commands of the Supreme Court. He says, "The lower courts are resisting this court's decisions in Heller and McDonald." McDonald is just a follow-on case that said that the Heller standard applies not just to the federal government, but also to the states. So he says, "The lower courts are resisting this court's decisions in Heller and McDonald and are failing to protect the Second Amendment to the same extent that they protect other constitutional rights." And he goes on in kind of a lengthy section to compare the Ninth Circuit's treatment of Second Amendment rights to the way it treats other areas. And he notably points to nude dancing and a Ninth Circuit case that struck down a 5-day waiting period for a nude dancing license and compares that to their allowing the 10-day waiting period on this Second Amendment right, the purchase of a firearm, without much scrutiny here. But he pins the blame for this, what he sees as this cavalier treatment by the lower courts, he pins the blame on the Supreme Court. And he says later in the opinion, he says, "Our continued refusal to hear Second Amendment cases only enables this kind of defiance. We have not heard argument in a Second Amendment case for nearly 8 years, and we have not clarified the standard for assessing Second Amendment Amendment claims for almost 10. Meanwhile, in this term alone, we have granted review in at least 5 cases involving the First Amendment and 4 cases involving the Fourth Amendment, even though our jurisprudence is much more developed in those rights." And he goes on to compare this to other areas of law. He speaks about abortion rights and First Amendment, including for hateful speech, and Fourth Amendment searches, and basically says if something comparable were happening in one of those areas, if a lower court had treated one of those areas this way, then he has no doubt that the court would have taken the case. And he uses the phrase constitutional orphan to refer to the Second Amendment. Now, this opinion has gotten a lot of criticism in the past couple days since it was issued. Some commentators have pointed to a number of other constitutional rights that they see as basically insufficiently protected by the Supreme Court, rights that have in theory been recognized as important constitutional rights, but in practice get little protection, and that may be a good point in terms of the substantive standard that Justice Thomas is complaining about. But I think Thomas has a point where he says basically there's kind of a disconnect between what the Supreme Court has said and what the lower courts are doing. Other rights that may be seen as insufficiently protected, that's often because the Supreme Court itself has explicitly established extremely weak protections, and lower courts are following the Supreme Court's guidance basically giving a low level of protection to those rights. On the other hand, here, the Supreme Court has very much taken this hands-off approach, which was somewhat unexpected. So I mentioned the court heard the D.C. v. Heller case, which put the kind of established firmly the Second Amendment right in 2008, and then the follow-on McDonald v. Chicago case in 2010 that said, yes, this applies to the states. Now, the Heller case was immediately criticized from all different sides for not sufficiently explaining what legal standard should apply and leaving numerous open questions as to how it should actually be applied in practice. But the expectation at the time was that now that the court had kind of put the Second Amendment out there, that there would be a number of these follow-on cases, follow-on Second Amendment cases that would start to kind of flesh out and define the applicable legal standards. Since then, that hasn't happened. There's been quite a few lower court cases, and lower court litigation has overwhelmingly been upholding gun regulations under Heller, saying that they don't violate the Heller standard, and overwhelmingly lower court challenges have been unsuccessful, and various types of gun regulations have remained in place. But the court has uniformly turned down applications for review in these cases. And so I think there can be a fair critique here that if the court is serious about Heller providing a real standard of constitutional protection, then, maybe the court ought to start taking some cases to flesh out what that looks like. And even if the court wants to cut back or believes that the right, should be limited or minimized, then, maybe it should be the court's, role to do that directly rather than letting the lower courts, basically undermine the Heller right because the Supreme Court is not stepping in to take any action. So, I think underneath that there may be a real fair critique about how the Supreme Court and the lower courts, the relationship between them, and how that's played out in this area of the law. The tone of this this opinion by Thomas has also gotten a lot of attention. There's both a direct criticism of the lower court, his talk about the lower court. Basically accusing the lower courts of trying to undermine the Supreme Court as being a resistance against the Supreme Court. That's unusual, but not unheard of also. You see that sometimes in Supreme Court cases, often in the areas of habeas corpus or qualified immunity cases, where the Supreme Court has repeatedly reversed certain lower court decisions for being insufficiently deferential to the government under those particular areas. And sometimes you see language that seems to suggest or even say flatly that the lower courts are ignoring the Supreme Court's guidance. Thomas's direct criticism of his fellow justices is also, it's not typical, but it's also not unheard of. The late Justice Scalia was particularly famous for his sharp language, sometimes criticizing his fellow justices. Maybe one of the more famous and kind of harshest examples is in the Obergefell case. That's the case establishing the right to same-sex marriage, where Justice Scalia was in the dissent. And he had one line famous or notorious, where he said, referring to the majority opinion, "If, even as the price to be paid for a fifth vote, I ever joined an opinion for the court that began," and then he goes on to quote the opening lines, and he says, "I would hide my head in a bag." So it's kind of, colorful language, but many saw it as just unnecessarily caustic toward his colleagues on the court. Another aspect of this case that's gotten a lot of attention is the timing of this opinion. So this is a Justice Thomas coming out with a opinion on Second Amendment, advocating for more Supreme Court protection of gun rights, issued less than a week after the deadly Parkland school shooting. And that's gotten a lot of attention, a lot of criticism for the justice for kind of putting out an opinion like this, especially at this particular time. In fairness to Justice Thomas, based on the docket in this case, it looks like the opinion was probably in the works already since sometime in early January. And it was, scheduled to be on this past Friday's conference back on January 31st. And the court's normal practice is opinions on orders like this are normally released in the first available orders list after the opinions are finished. It's often considered, at least to some degree, inappropriate for courts to kind of make political judgments about the timing of opinions. And there's just a general feeling that opinions should be issued, when they're ready, no sooner, no later. When the opinion is ready, it should go out, and the court shouldn't be trying to make judgments about when it will play better or whatever. So this resulted in some very bad optics. But, you know, maybe overall it's better than a situation where the courts are regularly trying to strategically time decisions with an eye toward how they're going to look in media coverage. I don't know. But that's about it for that case. Real quickly, I'm going to talk about one more thing that was on the orders list on Tuesday. And that was the court entered a judgment and decree in a case called Montana v. Wyoming in North Dakota. And this is one of these water rights disputes that the court hears every so often in its original jurisdiction. This was a dispute over the Tongue River about water flowing from Wyoming into Montana as part of the Yellowstone River system. And in cases like this, that don't come up from a lower court but are filed directly in the Supreme Court, the court generally just refers these cases to a special master. That special master kind of acts like a judge, hears the case, goes through the whole thing. Now, this case has actually been going on since 2007. So, you know, it's been more than a decade that this case has been pending before the Supreme Court with various proceedings in front of the special master. In January, the special master issued a final report kind of setting out the rules for future water management of this river. And, the states filed a letter, back in January, basically saying they had no, they were not taking any exceptions to the report and asking the court to just enter the proposed judgment. So that was on the docket, on the opinions, on the court's opinions on the website. But it's, you know, it's not, it's just kind of, another glimpse at these kind of long-running water disputes that are part of the Supreme Court's business, but kind of the court doesn't always take a very direct or active role in. So moving along, the next thing I wanted to mention quickly was the death penalty stay applications. And I mentioned that there were actually three different executions scheduled for today, February 22nd, one each in Florida, Alabama, and Texas. And I'm going to just run through real quickly. I have a lot more to cover, so I'm going to try and go a lot faster through things as I go along here. The three, and I'll just talk real briefly about what happened in each of them. One is named a convicted murderer named Eric Branch in Florida. And he had brought he was convicted and sentenced to death back in 1994. He had brought a claim arguing that the sentencing procedure that was used by Florida back at the time was unconstitutional. Now, it's undisputed that the Supreme Court later found that sentencing regime for the death penalty was unconstitutional, but they also found that it was not retroactive, so it didn't necessarily have to apply to cases that were already final and done with earlier before the Supreme Court made this rule. But he brought a challenge based on the way Florida had made it retroactive to certain earlier cases, but not other earlier cases, and said that this was unconstitutional. The Supreme Court, earlier tonight, this evening, his execution was scheduled for 6 p.m. And then earlier today, the Supreme Court, issued orders, denying his application for a stay and denying review of his case. And his execution, indeed, went forward, just a couple hours ago. And then the second case was a case of a man named Thomas Whitaker, and this was out of Texas. And, he was a man who in 2003, hired a hitman to murder his family in a staged home invasion. And, he was then convicted and sentenced to death. He had brought a challenge, against the lethal injection protocol in Texas, arguing that it was cruel and unusual punishment the way that they did this, and specifically complaining about his inability to get adequate discovery and so information about the details of their execution protocol. Now, he had made a petition and an application to the Supreme Court to stay his execution that was pending before the Supreme Court. However, there was a development 2 days ago where the Texas Parole Board recommended, and this is extremely unusual in Texas. It was a very unusual occurrence, but the Texas Parole Board recommended a commutation of his capital sentence to a life sentence. But it was an open question whether or not that would happen. Earlier this evening, Texas Governor Greg Abbott commuted his sentence just minutes before the execution was set to occur, taking that off the table. And the Supreme Court, as of the beginning of this live stream, the Supreme Court had taken no action on that that petition. Now that the sentence has been commuted, it's moot. It doesn't matter. But there's no way of knowing if the Supreme Court was intending to take any action or not. So the final of the three was a man named Doyle Ham, and he was convicted of a 1987 murder, some murder robberies in Mississippi and Alabama, and he was sentenced to death for the Alabama murder. And he filed another cruel and unusual punishment argument, application for a stay. And his argument was about the execution protocol and the issue that, he apparently had suffered from cancer, which apparently is now in remission, but he has, collapsed veins that don't give access for the lethal injection. And there have been previous botched executions, that have been, blamed on, the person administering the lethal injection being unable to actually hit the vein and just injecting the lethal injection drugs into the surrounding tissue, which has led to these prolonged painful deaths. So he was arguing that this, because of his veins, this would be cruel and unusual. And this, as of the beginning of this live stream, Justice Thomas was the circuit justice for this is coming out of the 11th circuit, and each circuit, this is the geographical regions of the country. There's a particular justice who's assigned to that to deal with, emergency applications for stays that come out of that circuit. Now on these death penalty stays, applications, usually they will refer these to the whole court, but if there isn't time for that and a decision needs to be made quickly, then that justice will often act alone, and then later seek to bring it to the whole court, if necessary or if that's possible, depending on what they decided. Now, Justice Thomas issued an order staying the execution, pending a further decision by the court. And this was a very last minute application for a stay. So the other ones had, the applications for stays had been made, a few days ago, and the petitions to the Supreme Court had come in, a month or two ago in those other two executions. But the application in this case was just filed earlier today, in the middle of the day today. So it was very last minute. And so Justice Thomas acted on it, on his own without the whole court. And as of the beginning of this live stream, there'd been no further action. So right now it's up in the air. That's the kind of thing where the court could decide they're going to, they want to take a look at this case. They think there's some merit to it, and they could stay it pending consideration of a petition, and potentially actually accept this case and hear it. Or it could be the kind of thing that an hour from now, or even during the course of this live stream, the court comes back and as a whole court decides to deny the application for a stay, and then the execution could go forward later tonight. So there we had it. Three executions scheduled tonight. One already happened. One got commuted by the governor, and so it didn't happen. And one is up in the air right now with the court temporarily staying it, no idea, what's going to happen in the long run. All right, so I'm going to move on. I mentioned that on Wednesday there were four opinions issued by the court. I'm going to run through them really quickly. The first is called Digital Realty Trust v. Summers, and this was about whistleblower protections under the Dodd-Frank Act. And the issue here was that the Whistleblower Protection Act provided protections for whistleblowers, but whistleblower has kind of a broad popular meaning. There's a lot of types of reporting of misconduct that could be classified as whistleblowing. But the Dodd-Frank Act specifically defined a whistleblower as someone, in this context, it was someone who provides certain information to the SEC. Now, the argument in this case, the fact was that the individual involved, it was an employee of Digital Realty Trust who reported internally suspected securities law violations to senior management, didn't inform the SEC, but it reported internally, and then was later fired and brought this action saying it was unlawful retaliation. The court came down, and it was essentially unanimous. The court said that the statute was very clear, that the whistleblower definition only applies to people who report to the SEC. He didn't report to SEC, therefore he's not a whistleblower under the terms of the statute. internal whistleblowers inside a company, people reporting internally, are only protected if they have also brought the information to the SEC. The opinion was written by Justice Ginsburg. It was essentially unanimous. However, there was a concurrence by Justice Thomas, joined by Justices Alito and Gorsuch, that rejected a portion of Justice Ginsburg's decision that relied on a Senate committee report to talk about the purposes that were motivating the statute. And they argued that just these Senate committee reports shouldn't be seen as reliable evidence of the senator's intent, and also that it's just not the formally enacted law. The committee reports are not the law, and they should just be relying on the statute. This was interesting because this type of rejection of these references to statutory history, the legislative history, were kind of a trademark of the late Justice Scalia. It was very common sight for to see opinions where he had joined the opinion of the court except for a particular footnote. So it would say Justice Scalia joins except with respect to footnote 3 or something like that. And inevitably when that happened, that footnote was some discussion of the legislative history, which Justice Scalia refused to sign on to. He was usually alone in this. It was usually just Justice Scalia that was kind of staking out this position of not agreeing, not citing legislative history. And after Scalia's death, many people thought this kind of quirky practice was over, but now it looks like Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch have kind of revived this tradition by, you know, specifically rejecting to the section discussing statutory legislative history, even though they come to the same result in the case. So that's just an interesting development, and it'll be interesting to see if that, to what extent they keep doing this in the future going forward. There was also a concurrence by Justice Sotomayor joined by Justice Breyer, and that was just, it was a very brief concurrence just responding to Justice Thomas's concurrence and in endorsing the use of these committee reports as particularly reliable forms of legislative history. So the end result of this is the Dodd-Frank Act doesn't provide protection to people who only internally report and don't go to the SEC. So it's hard to say what broader impact that'll have on employees or employers, because there's always the possibility of protection when someone reports internally but also talks to the SEC. Then they would be protected. So let me move on. The next opinion is a case called Class v. United States. And this is a case about the effect of a guilty plea on a criminal defendant's right to appeal the constitutionality of the statute that they were convicted under. Now, if you want more background on this case, I actually had an interview. I did an interview with Jessica Ring Amundson, who was the attorney for Rodney Class, who was the criminal defendant in this case. And it was episode 21 of the Counting to Five podcast. You can find it on YouTube or in the audio podcast, where I interviewed her and she kind of talked about the legal arguments and the background of the case a bit on that. But the basic story is Rodney Class was indicted for possessing guns in a locked car that was parked in a parking lot located on the Capitol grounds in DC. And there's a statute that made it illegal to possess guns on the Capitol grounds. He, in the course of he defended himself and challenged the constitutionality of the charge. He argued that there was a due process violation because there was inadequate notice of where the boundaries of the Capitol grounds were. There was no way for him to know that by parking this parking lot, he was on Capitol grounds. And he also brought a Second Amendment claim saying that this was just not a constitutional restriction on Second Amendment rights. The district court rejected his challenges. He ended up pleading guilty. After his guilty plea, he immediately appealed, bringing back his constitutional arguments, the due process and Second Amendment arguments. When he pleaded guilty, he agreed to a plea bargain, a plea agreement, and that plea agreement specifically waived certain rights. He said he could not appeal certain types of things. It was silent on the right to appeal on constitutional grounds. So he says the plea bargain didn't say he waives these rights, so he can still appeal those. He won here. This was an opinion by Justice Breyer. It was a 6-3 opinion. He was joined by Chief Justice Roberts, Justices Ginsburg, Sotomayor, Kagan, and Gorsuch. And this case, and there was a dissent on the other side, and it was a dissent by Justice Alito, joined by Justices Kennedy and Thomas. The basic argument, there's really a very strong disagreement between the majority and dissent here about what the historical practice and what the court's previous cases really say about this kind of right. The argument of the majority is that they say that there's basically a long tradition that a guilty plea means you're conceding your factual guilt to the allegations made against you, and also conceding certain types of technical defects, that you're waiving your right to challenge certain technical defects in the prosecution. But to the extent that the facts that are alleged don't amount to a crime, and that would be under the majority's view, that's the argument here. If the crime that you've been convicted under is unconstitutional in the first place, then you're not bound to that guilty plea if what you've pled guilty to as a legal matter is not really a crime. And they point to two opinions from the 1970s that slightly different circumstances, but that the majority says back up this view. The dissent just has a very different view of the history, and they say that historically a guilty plea is much broader than that. You're not only conceding when you plead guilty that you're guilty to the facts that are alleged against you, but you're also conceding that the acts you're accused of constitute a crime. You're making both factual and legal concessions, and the dissent really disagrees with the majority's outline of the history involved. Interestingly, for many criminal defendants pleading guilty, this decision will probably not have any real effect going forward, because the likely result of this is the standard federal plea agreements used by federal prosecutors will start to routinely include explicit waivers of the right to appeal on grounds that the statute was unconstitutional, the statute of conviction was unconstitutional. So this will just become another piece of standard plea agreement waivers of appeal rights. And so someone in Rodney Class's position in the future who agrees to a plea agreement, pleads guilty subject to a plea agreement, would be forced to waive his right to appeal in future cases. However, there are a significant percentage, and it was at oral argument, the counsel for the federal government said that it was basically about 25% of guilty pleas in the federal courts are without any sort of plea agreement. They're just the defendant pleads guilty but has no agreement with the government. So in those cases, this decision would make a difference, and those people would retain the right to challenge the constitutionality of the statute they're convicted under. The next case, next opinion that was decided, a case called Rubin v. Islamic Republic of Iran. And this is a case about the extent to which the property of foreign sovereigns is immune from the processes of U.S. courts. This was a unanimous opinion by Justice Sotomayor, except for Justice Kagan, who was recused presumably because she had some involvement in this case during her time as Solicitor General before she joined the court. This involved a 1997 Hamas suicide bombing in Jerusalem, and a lawsuit was brought by survivors of the bombing and relatives against Iran, alleging that Iran was liable due to their material support and training for Hamas. Now, what it comes down to is the idea of foreign sovereign immunity, the idea that foreign sovereigns, foreign countries, just are generally immune from legal action in U.S. courts. Iran, in this particular circumstance, was able to be brought into court because there was an exception made. Congress had passed an exception for designated state sponsors of terrorism, which included Iran, that let them be sued. And the plaintiffs in the case, these survivors and relatives, got a default judgment against Iran. Iran didn't actually appear in court, and the court ruled against Iran and awarded $71.5 million. The problem is, you get a judgment against Iran for $71.5 million. How do you collect that money? Iran doesn't really have assets in the United States that can easily be seized. What they sought to do was to execute this judgment against something known as the Persepolis Collection, which is a archaeological collection of 30,000 clay tablets that were excavated in the 1930s and then loaned in 1937 to the University of Chicago and have been held there for study ever since. And so they said basically, well, this is property of Iran that's present in the United States. We can seize it. They basically wanted to seize these archaeological artifacts to satisfy this multi-million-dollar judgment. And what it all came down to was a provision of the foreign sovereign immunity law, which creates a standard for when property that belongs to an agency or instrumentality of a foreign sovereign, when that can be used to satisfy a judgment against the foreign sovereign. And there was a dispute over whether that particular provision alone would allow people to seize certain property, or whether that provision just said that if there is other provisions that allow you to seize the property, then the fact that it's an agency or instrumentality under this provision doesn't get in the way. The court decided that it wasn't a freestanding position that let them seize the property. So the plaintiffs in that case lost. They're not going to get to seize these ancient clay tablets. Before I move on, I had a question in the live chat, and the question is what does the rejection of a specific part of a decision do in affecting the precedent of the decision moving forward? If we're referring back to for example the case where justices Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch rejected the legislative history part of the case. In that case, it doesn't matter because there's still a clear majority of the court that agrees to every portion of it. So the fact that these three are dissenting from that one part of the decision doesn't make any difference. In a different case, if enough justices dissented or disagreed, refused to join a portion of the opinion so that portion of the opinion no longer had a majority of the court, no longer had a majority, then that would no longer be what's called the opinion of the court. That portion of the opinion would no longer be the official opinion of the court. It would just be an opinion of some, smaller number of justices. And so it wouldn't be binding in the same way. Now, this can get very complicated because sometimes when you take a piece out of an opinion like that, the rest of the opinion, even without that piece, is still kind of sufficient to really explain the full judgment of the court, and that can still be kind of a full majority. But sometimes you have situations where if certain parts of an opinion no longer have a majority of the court on board and are no longer part of the opinion of the court, then you don't really have a fully reasoned opinion. And in those cases, this is a very complicated situation. Something called the Marx rule comes into play where you try and figure out of the different views by different justices on the court, which one is supports the judgment on the narrowest grounds, and it gets very complicated. There's actually a case that's going to get into that very issue later this term. I think it's going to be argued in April this term, but that can get pretty complicated again. But where there's still a majority of the justices behind a particular provision, then it's not a problem. I have one more question in the live stream, which is, asking, this is about the Rodney Class case. Are there specific rights that person cannot waive when agreeing to a plea? Generally, person can waive pretty much everything. You can waive your right to appeal pretty much across the board. There's certain things. Your right to ineffective assistance of counsel is one that you can't really waive because if your counsel isn't properly advising you on the plea agreement, then you wouldn't know. You wouldn't be competent necessarily to take the agreement and so you can't that's one that you often can't waive, and that's usually exempted from the standard plea agreements. You retain the right, but for the most part, most rights to appeal can be waived pretty freely in a plea agreement. I'm going to move on. There's one last opinion that came out this week called Murphy v. Smith. Now, this is the only opinion this week that broke down. It was a 5-4 decision along kind of the stereotypical conservative liberal lines. So you had Justice Gorsuch writing for a 5-justice majority. It was the 5 more conservative members of the court. And Justice Sotomayor wrote a dissent for the 4 more liberal members of the court. And this was a case about fee-shifting provisions in prisoner civil rights lawsuits. So what this is about is in civil litigation in the U.S., attorney's fees are usually governed by what's called the American rule. And the American rule is just each side pays their own attorney's fees. Win or lose, you pay your own attorney's fees. The other side pays their attorney's fees. You don't get your attorney's fees back just because you win the case. That's the normal rule in most civil litigation. There are some exceptions. Sometimes there's a statute that provides for attorney's fee shifting. So the big one is when someone brings a action under Section 1983, that's just a federal statute that's the major federal statute for bringing civil rights actions against state and local officials. There's another provision that goes along with Section 1983. It's called Section 1988, and that allows a victorious plaintiff to recover their attorney's fees. And there's some discretion involved for the judge in awarding those fees, but often a victorious plaintiff will be able to recover their attorney's fees. Now, there's another provision that applies when the plaintiff in the case is a prisoner. And that's a provision called Section 1997E, which allows for this fee shifting. However, it has this provision that says, a portion of the prisoner's judgment not to exceed 25% shall be applied to satisfy the amount of attorney's fees awarded against the defendant. Now, the issue here is there's two ways you can interpret that language. It says a portion of the prisoner's judgment not to exceed 25%. Do they mean that you basically, the attorney's fees will be satisfied from the prisoner's judgment? So you'll take the prisoner gets their legal judgment. You start satisfying the attorney's fees with that money, and you either pay the full amount of the attorney's fees, or if you hit 25% of the judgment, then it's capped. And the prisoner doesn't have to pay more than that 25%. That's one way to read it. The other way to read a portion of the prisoner's judgment not to exceed 25% is not that you mandatorily provide full satisfaction of the attorney's fees up to 25% and cap it there, but that it's just a discretionary provision where the judge can rule that some amount of the prisoner's judgment goes to attorney's fees anywhere up to 25%. So somewhere between 0 and 25% gets applied to the attorney's fees, and then the rest will have to be paid by the defendants. The issue, the facts in this case were where you had the plaintiff Murphy was beaten by prison guards. It resulted in a crushed eye socket and permanently blurred vision, and so he sued and brought this lawsuit. He won. And just here, I've rounded these numbers a little bit for simplicity, but basically he got a damages award of about $300,000. He also got awarded attorney's fees of $100,000. Now, 25% of his damages award, his $300,000 damage award, would be about $75,000. So under the interpretation that he has to pay up to 25% of his damages toward the attorney's fees, he would get $300,000 minus $75,000 that would go to his attorneys, and then the other $25,000 to pay the attorneys would come from the defendants, so they'd have to pay the rest of the attorney's fees above that. The district court, the judge, however, decided not to require him to pay the full 25%, but only to pay 10%. And so that came out to only about $30,000 instead of $75,000, and that meant more money that had to come out of the defendant's pocket. So they had to pay the difference between the $30,000 and the $100,000, so more like $70,000 instead of just the $25,000 that they would have had to pay under the other interpretation. The Court of Appeals reversed the district court and said, no, he has to pay the full 25%. So it's up at the Supreme Court. And so this was really just a disagreement about how to interpret this statutory language. The majority says, it says, shall be applied to satisfy. It says this language, shall, that means it's mandatory. It's saying there's some mandatory thing that has to happen. And satisfy suggests discharging an obligation in full. It's fully paying some obligation. So to the extent that they can, in up to 25% of their award, they're supposed to, as fully as possible under that 25%, they're supposed to satisfy the obligation. And they said Congress, if they'd wanted to just make this a discretionary thing, they could have easily made it clearly discretionary, could have said the judge has the discretion to award up to 25% or something like that. And also they say that the context of this provision, it was to try to reduce judges' discretion and make a more formulaic process. The dissent disagrees and basically says satisfy can be used and is often used to mean to go toward satisfying something. And they give an example. They say if you make a credit card payment, and you could say that payment is applied to satisfy a debt, even if it's only a partial payment and isn't fully paying down the debt. They also point out that average damage awards are very small, and it's the unusual case where the full attorney's fees could be paid out of 25% of the judgment. And they also just respond back and say Congress could have clearly specified the majority's reading too. This is ambiguous, could be read either way, and the fact that Congress could have been more clear can cut either way. They also point to the language where it refers to a portion of the judgment and not to exceed 25%, and say this language portion and not to exceed just implies that there's some sort of some degree of discretion going on there. So that's that case. So that's going to basically that was a loss for prisoner litigants who will have to pay more of their court judgments toward attorney's fees than they would have if there was more discretion involved. So that's the four opinions for this week. I may try and put out a podcast episode on one or more of these opinions, going into more detail and breaking it down a little more. I don't know if that's going to happen yet or not, but you can keep your eye out for that as we go forward. Really quickly, I know I'm running a little long today. I like to keep these under an hour if I can, but I'm going to talk quickly about the cases that are coming up next week. I'm going to keep these extremely brief. There's five cases coming up next week for oral argument. Three of those cases, I've already put out podcast episodes specifically previewing those cases. So I'm just going to really quickly, on Monday, the court is going to first hear a case called Janus v. American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. I put a preview out. It's episode 33 of the podcast on YouTube or the audio podcast. And this is kind of a very high profile case about the constitutionality of public employee unions collecting agency fees. Those are fees charged to non-union members, people who don't want to be members of the union, but fees they still have to contribute to the union to pay their share of collective bargaining and union representational expenses. And it's a First Amendment challenge to that, arguing that this is a compelled speech and by these employees, where they're being compelled to support speech by the unions that they don't approve of. The second case on Monday is called Ohio v. American Express. And this is, I did a preview of this as episode 34 of the podcast. And that is an antitrust case. And it's about credit card companies and how you apply the antitrust standard when a credit card company is involved in two different interrelated markets. There's a relationship between a credit card company and the merchants who accept that credit card in credit card transactions. So they have a financial relationship between American Express and any merchant who accepts American Express. They have a contractual relationship and certain financial relationship. But American Express also has a second relationship with the customers, the cardholders who hold an American Express card. And it's important for American Express to simultaneously be functioning in both of these markets, and its actions in one of those two markets can affect the other side of the market. And so the question is, when you're doing antitrust analysis, whether they're engaged in anti-competitive practices, how do you consider, to what extent do you have to consider both sides of this market? If, for example, they're alleged to be doing something anti-competitive in one side of the market, but they argue that it has pro-competitive effects in the other side of the market. So that's that case. Then the third case of the week, there's a case called United States v. Microsoft. That's coming up on Tuesday, February 27th. I released an episode on that, episode 35 of the podcast. That's about the Stored Communications Act, which is a 1986 law that governs the government's access to email communications in like a criminal prosecution. If they want to get someone's email to try and prove as evidence of a crime, and the issue there, it's an interesting issue, is it's an issue about extraterritoriality. It's an issue about the facts in that case are that Microsoft, for the particular email account that the government was trying to obtain, they were trying to obtain emails from a particular account. Microsoft actually had that particular account was stored on a server in Ireland, and Microsoft argued that because it was outside of the territory of the United States, then it wasn't within the coverage of the statute. And it's an interesting case because it's just a different disagreement. There's a general principle that when Congress passes statutes and doesn't specify the territorial application, statutes are generally confined to the territory of the United States and don't apply extraterritorially. However, here there's different arguments about how exactly you draw that line. And Microsoft, or the United States, argues because Microsoft had access from within the United States to these emails, even though they were stored outside, Microsoft could access and produce them from within the United States, so that was still within the coverage of the statute. So that's an interesting one. So there's two more cases that I haven't, at least yet, I don't know if I will, but I haven't done individual episodes going into these, so I'm going to talk about them real quick now. The other Tuesday case this week, the other case on Tuesday, February 27th, is called Bozeman v. City of Riviera Beach, Florida. And this is a case with some kind of interesting facts. It's basically this person named Fane Lozman who lives in Riviera Beach, Florida. And this is the second time he's been up to the Supreme Court over his battles with the Riviera Beach City Council. He's kind of made himself something of a nuisance to the city council related to waterfront development plans. And as a result, the city council basically has it out for him. They actually had a closed-door meeting with the transcripts of this meeting were later released, as they had to under open records laws. And the council members were explicitly talking about basically trying to get him, intimidating him, sending him a message, very explicitly had a agenda out to get him. As they made an attempt to have, he lives on a houseboat in the city marina. They attempted to have him evicted. A jury rejected that and found that the city was retaliating against him. They later seized and destroyed his houseboat, so destroyed his home. He brought that all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, where he won, and it was determined, it was declared that they had acted illegally. Then what brings him to the court this time is that he was speaking at a public comment at a city council meeting, alleging corruption in local government. And the city council member basically ordered the police at the meeting to have him arrested. And the whole incident is caught on video. It's pretty clear that he was arrested at the order of a council member. He was charged with disorderly conduct and nonviolently resisting arrest, but those charges were dropped. He sued the city for First Amendment retaliation. And the issue that's going on here is it enough for him to show that that retaliation motivated his arrest? Because it seems pretty clear he has a very strong case and has lots of evidence to show that the city was motivated to retaliate against him. However, the city argues that as long as they can come up with any theory of arrest where there was actual probable cause to arrest him, even if it wasn't what actually motivated them at the time, then that kind of protects them from this retaliation claim. And there is a precedent that has a similar requirement that applies when you argue retaliatory prosecution. Now, this is retaliatory arrest, and there's arguments that Lozman makes about why that's different from prosecution. It shouldn't apply, but that's the issue here. And the final case of next week will be heard on Wednesday, February 28th. And this is a case called Minnesota Voters Alliance v. Mansky. And this is about a Minnesota statute that says a political badge, political button, or other political insignia may not be worn at or about the polling place on primary or election day. Now, the facts in this particular case was that a man was turned away at the voting booth. He was wearing a Tea Party t-shirt with a Gadsden flag and the Don't Tread on Me logo, and also a button that said "Please ID me," and that's kind of a reference to the political debates over the appropriateness and legality of voter ID laws at polling places. The challengers to this Minnesota law, they argue that a few things. They say this is just a clear violation of First Amendment rights by prohibiting core political speech. And they say that there isn't really a legitimate government purpose that's served by this, and that it's so vague what counts as a political badge or political button, and it invites discriminatory application by poll workers who don't like a particular message to kind of classify it as political as opposed to just general non-political speech. And so they argue that this should be struck down as unconstitutional. Minnesota defends it. They say that this is a non-public forum. So basically the polling place is for purposes of elections is not just a place for public speech. It's for a particular purpose, the voting function, and that the government is allowed to restrict speech in that area consistent with the purposes of that election, of just conducting a fair election. And also that part of the reason for this is to prevent intimidation if you have people coming in with these strong political slogans and things that might intimidate people or prevent people from feeling free to vote. There is one kind of key precedent is a Supreme Court case from 1992 called Burson v. Freeman, which upheld a ban on campaigning within 100 feet of a polling place. And Minnesota argues that this is kind of the same idea, that there's a accepted principle that as long as you have a neutral law, you're not targeting specific viewpoints or specific sides of a debate, that you can stop people from campaigning once they're closer inside of the polling place. And so they're arguing that that supports them. The challengers argue that this is a very different situation. That was talking about, you know, campaigners who are setting up and handing out literature or having signs or things like that. And this is talking about the actual voters themselves, the people who are coming in to cast their ballots and trying to exclude them from coming in wearing certain messages. So that's an interesting free speech case that'll be coming up next week. So that wraps it up for what I've got tonight. Ran a little longer than I hoped, but there was a lot in there. And so that's the end of this. That'll be the end of tonight's live stream. The next live stream will be a week from today, Thursday, February 29th. That's not right. Thursday, March 1st at 9 p.m. Eastern time. Our usual weekly live stream time is every Thursday at 9 p.m., but you can always check the Counting to Five YouTube channel to find the latest or the next scheduled live stream in case we depart from that regular schedule. I'm not sure yet what the topic of next week's live stream will be. There may be more opinions or other interesting developments coming out. If there are, then I'll probably focus on that. Otherwise, I'll probably use the opportunity to take a closer look at one of the other court's cases that they're hearing this term. Whether you're watching on YouTube or listening to the audio podcast, I'd love your feedback. You can leave your comments on the show notes at countingto5.com, on the Counting to Five YouTube channel or Facebook page, or tweet at Counting to Five, or send me an email at mike@countingto5.com. Please subscribe to the Counting to Five YouTube channel or the audio podcast to make sure you don't miss future episodes. And if you have further questions about any of the cases I discussed tonight, if you'd specifically like me to go into more detail on particular cases or to do an episode devoted to one of those, just let me know, and I will definitely take that into account. I'm always interested in listener feedback and always trying to bring you the content that you are looking for. And so that wraps things up. Thank you for listening. This has been Counting to Five.